Hi, Michael.
Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Loud
Can
and
you hear
clear.
me? Oh, loud and clear. Oh, that's good. I thought I was whispering. How you doing, Markle?
I'm okay. Yep.
How's the weather there in Colorado?
The weather. Well, it's kind of a snowy day today. We're oscillating, doing the springtime shuffle, making our way out of winter. But today is winter's persistence. But not bad at all, really. It's just coming down very lightly, and most of it being
Oh,
thick.
okay. Okay. Yeah, we
How
have
about you?
does it stay pretty steady there in California for you, Michael?
Right now we've been hopping back and forth between warming up and cold, especially at night, and windy weather. So that's here in the desert, Southern California. That's how it works for us as far as the transition into springtime. Got the little guy with you, huh, Doug?
Yeah, he's a little under the weather. A sinus type of issue. He's keeping good spirits. Keeping me
Good.
busy.
Yeah, one of ours staying home today too. The girls go to school one to public school one day a week. And today is the day, but B woke up with vomiting and she's home too. I can't tell. Is that Vincent?
This is Vincent. He just observed the, I forget what it is in the Hopsetter book, but the reclining cartoon image of the boy thinking about reclining himself, thinking about himself reclining tonight, or at least 4 or 5 times. I don't think you can draw beyond the pinpoint. But he likes that boy.
Marco, you posted quite a few things on Ukraine I really like.
Oh yeah, anything in particular?
No, actually, just the fact that you posted on what was happening, the whole, it's like you set a tone of awareness about what was going on with Ukraine. I've been seeing some pieces on Integral Life. They've been doing a lot. I mean, there's a lot out there of people really trying to talk about this issue, and there's of course a lot of stuff around it because it's white on white, and that part of the art of the discussion. It's not the only part, but it's a legitimate view of how we treat people in Yemen and Syria.
I think so. What I think is most salient, maybe for like the world as a whole, is just the prospect, the possibility of a nuclear war. I think that's what makes it a little bit different than other conflicts that might be going on in, Somalia or Rwanda or
Well,
wherever else.
would it be fair to say that we haven't faced this kind of intensity of nuclear since the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I'm not sure. It seemed like I don't remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't remember what it was like.
I see.
But do you?
I remember my parents, when I was old enough to figure out, I remember my parents acting very nervous, very fucking nervous of what was going on. I do remember that.
Well, I think that as a parent, I have been acting nervous. And my
Yeah.
wife, Kayla, and I have been acting nervous. And it's something we've been thinking about
Yeah.
and talking about. And even before this invasion, with the coronavirus, and even before the coronavirus, with political unrest, and even before the political unrest, with the kind of awareness of climate crisis, and instability in the world. You know, like there's a sense that how can we be prepared, or how should we be prepared for that kind of eventuality? Yeah. Like in a practical sense, like you had to leave your house in, you know, like 24 hours or less. If you had to leave your house in 10 minutes, do you know what you would take with you? What's important to you? What is essential? What might be useful if you are going to be a refugee? Or imagine that something breaks out in terms of a conflict, like there's an escalation very quickly, and the countries start launching missiles against each other. Okay, well, maybe one of the targets would be Denver. Like maybe another would be Los Angeles. Like maybe some of those missiles would get through. Maybe some of them would go astray. I mean, this is like totally worst case scenario planning, but at the same time, it's not like unreal. And probably a lot of folks in Ukraine were going about their daily lives not really believing that the worst could happen. And now it's happened. Yeah. I think, anyway, like we do go down those rabbit holes and think about that kind of a thing. And I do think about it. And I think it does have a spillover effect as far as what the girls are aware of. They're not focusing on it.
Yeah. I just know maybe with my maturity and both personal and, you know, the civil rights and certain things at times in American history and the history of the world of totally different now, because I think of the social media just ups the ante as far as it's right in our face all the time, you know, versus just the newspaper and stuff. And one of the things that helps me regulate my anxiety, I'm not saying I suppress it at all, but the best metaphor for me is it's like something's trying to be birthed and it's going intensely. I use my personal experience of watching the birth of my children, and I just extrapolate out that kind of intensity feels like it's happening now around the world. And like what I had to learn for being a part of that is I had to do my best to be calm, which at that time I did my best. But since then I've learned to better not be in denial, but how to regulate my response to the immediate threat, if that makes sense.
I think so. I mean, I remember growing up with that sense of being in a Cold War and being like in a world where something terrible could happen like that, and you'd have to take cover. You'd have to, in our school, for example, we had drills, right? Like duck and cover drills.
They were still having them when you grew up. They had them when I grew up.
Well, this would have been the 80s in my case, and so we were still in the Cold War, and it was beginning. There was some thawing when Gorbachev came into power and started dialoguing with Reagan and perestroyka, and an attempt to kind of move Russia beyond the Soviet system. I think, but there was just a special bell. It was different than the fire bell. And then when it would ring, we'd have to get up and go out into the hallway and duck down, with our heads in our arms up against the wall, like almost like we were like prisoners in a certain way. Like I didn't think of it that way at the time, but you had a group of prisoners, you might have them do that. Who knows what good that would do. We also had a shelter in our school basement, and it had a sign on the outside that was the nuclear, symbol. So that was, where people in the community go. But I guess, just like as far as this is active, right? Like this is happening right now. This is now mm-hmm. our reality. Right. And like when we look back on this history from 20, 40 or 50 years, we might see this as, you know, the equivalent of Hitler invading Poland. Maybe that's a parallel. Maybe that's, you know, it's like the start of what we'll end up calling World War III or something like that. But that's also like, could be, you know, just a form of like fear mongering or a fear form of exaggeration.
Well, and that's at percentage wise, as far as people on the planet of learning how to, I think that's what's got to come forward. If we're going to resolve anything, we got to get more people learning how to regulate dealing with the fire drill. and when things act, you know, come and there should be a certain amount of training of what do you do when something disastrous happens? So where do you go? Like in California, it's earthquakes. Where are you supposed to stand? You know, and be careful going outside. There's preparation. But I have a question: is this time and what's happening makes me really, really cynical about the strange loop. It's pissing me off, his take on it, because the emotional visceral response doesn't jive with the abstraction or, you know, the theory. It just doesn't jive with me.
Well, let's talk about that. This would be our third session. Hofstadter's I'm a Strange Loop.
Yeah.
And there is, I think, at least I will concur, like I feel a disconnect. I've been reading it and I've been like, you know, giving it, trying to absorb and kind of understand what he's trying to say. And, you know, I'm not practiced. When I was young, I was good at math, but I have not been practicing my mathematical, you know, reasoning skills for a while. So it's challenging to follow him through like his, you know, just his way of thinking and his way of this, you know, just what he's talking about with Gödel and the Principia Mathematica. It's challenging to follow. But I've tried my best. However, it's a stretch to give attention to that kind of thing when there is this other reality, you know, this other event unfolding. And it's something that I want to give actually more thought to. You know, like I posted that piece on war because I wanted to think about it. Like I did, it was pressing. Whereas the exact kind of like logic of how my eye might arise from, you know, this kind of symbolic processing that occurs in my brain as it like, you know, takes in inputs and then like creates this mirage of a self, it's less interesting. And now here we are, the three of us. John was on the mood for this kind of, you know, this discussion. I think Matthew had work to go back to work. And I'm not sure where he is, but maybe he had this something similar. we don't know. Like that's another eye, right? That take to us right now.
And Ed's not on. I thought he was coming. I talked to him earlier in the week. Okay.
And Ed's not here. And Lisa isn't either. So he's like a. It's almost like this loop has a centrifugal kind of force. So it's like spinning people off or flying, you know, it's fragmenting. And I wonder what's up with that? What do you?
Yeah.
It could be just a simple technical issue that they're unable to log in, but.
It could be. I just want to say, I like the fact that there's three of us. The number three is special to me, that there's three of us, but I know that there can be technical issues. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I know that there can be technical issues, but I'm probably overstating my case, but I do feel that there's a practical emotional speculation going on of there's some emotional vibrational intensity that's forcing people to maybe choose different places to be at this time because of where they're at, feeling the world vibe, the field with everything going on. I think that's a component that's happening. And I will say this, I feel whether they realize it or not, I think I'm just much more embodied of understanding how we're both we're all individual eyes, but there, this notion that we're isolated and separate is a little overstated in my case, from my point of view, if that makes sense, Marco.
Is that a commentary on Hofstadter's thesis?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't take everything he says as wrong. I just think like a lot of, and you called him a mentalist in one of your last posts rather than a materialist. And you hit the nail on the head, is the mentalist tends to really not give equal weight to the body and the senses as far as even coming up with our ideas and concepts. It seems to me.
Well, I mean, I think the sign of that in the book is how often he talks about the brain as if it were its own thing. And it also, I'm generalizing. I mean, it'd be good to get into the text and tease this out, and maybe we could do that if it's worth our time.
please do, because I've skimmed it, and in skimming it, you're getting my. I've skimmed it, so you're getting my points of view from that point of view.
I've read it, but I again, like with the math stuff and like precise loops, like the exact loops of his arguments, I wouldn't be able to reproduce them. Like I haven't internalized those patterns. My summary is that I think this ends in solipsism. I think it ends in, because if the eye is a phenomenon of the brain, and even there's something very fuzzy that happens, and something that I think Hofstadter elides. Like he conflates these things. Like that there are certain patterns that arise in the brain, and when those patterns have a sufficient amount of kind of complexity and self-referentiality, and they've absorbed, you know, many other patterns, they, you know, it's the eye, that brain has arisen in a body that, that appears to be singular, or that is seen as singular, and then language, it enters into language, into the linguistic sphere. It assumes a name, or it's given a name, and then there's a grammar. Right, to how the I forms. But if that's where our self and subjectivity and consciousness only occurs, if it doesn't occur before that or outside of that, if it's only in the symbolic play of self-referential, loop, I think that we're leaving out everything that's in the context, everything that's in the wider context. Like there's a lot more going on.
Okay, can I reference something? Because I like the way you did that. I guess I'm trying to really work what we learned from wholeness with Goethe and his exact sensory imagination in terms of observation from a scientific point of view. You know, that you really have to train your senses to go into the phenomenon, not just stand back. I feel resonance with Goethe's way of actually engaging that doesn't leave out that, from my understanding, you know, you still need to step back, but it seems he's more, he, the way he works it, it's like a dance more than a hidden Star Trek post on a thing, just observing, you know, a culture, but being hidden from it. You know what I mean? Have you ever seen that Star Trek where they had these outposts in these different cultures, and one of them, their hidden shield got exposed, and so guess what? They're, you know, the first thing is you're not supposed to interfere.
So, I mean, what to you would be like the salient differences between like Hofstadter's approach to mind or to phenomena, like, and say Goethe's, like, as we learned about studying Bartoft?
Roughly speaking, thank you for that question. It's too separate from the environment as a whole. As Johnny has said, we as individuals and brains, we exist in an environment, but where our brains, our rational capacity, can actually compartmentalize and then forget that's what we did. It seems that's what he's doing, or that's the feeling tone I guess I'm picking up is because he seems to be He seems to be leaving out something that I think is significant.
And if I may try to enter the conversation.
Go for it, Doug.
Attempting to use what we've talked about at the beginning. And with Douglas Hofstadter's presentation style, it's almost a little bit like not like Sloterdijk's writing at all, but he uses images to convey his meaning quite frequently. And most of these images are personal images, whether it's the video feedback or he has an image of, we haven't read the chapter yet, but the next chapter, the last page that we look at if we finish our reading, is him and another woman kind of pointing at each other's nose. So, and that's kind of an odd loop. If you look at it, you almost identify with one of them. And then because there's somebody else's hand there, you identify with the other. So it is a strange loop. And he gives all these examples through images. And another image is of him and a group of people kind of sitting on top of each other, where they almost don't have to sit. It's like sitting on a chair, but they're all suspended in air. If you tried to do it yourself, you would fall down on your rear end. But he's having fun doing these sessions. Maybe that was a class he had. And he was a teacher at some point. And that comes through in the book, but at the same time, his theory doesn't seem to take into account all the fun, all the messiness, all the odd goings on that go on in life. Like we're saying, the brain, what he's talking about, the self is an illusion, the magic waving of consciousness just sort of comes about. And I think his theory, for me at least, and maybe it's his mathematical mind, so he's talking about Gödel and then into Russell and Whitehead's Principia Mathematica and all this, what I wish would be just simply summed up into a couple words, that it's kind of odd, and we're beyond the mathematics, or there's much more than just a logical structure to things. And this self-referential looping that goes on in mathematics in our life is important, but as a theory, his theory is kind of lacking in my mind. He brings up memory a couple times, and he comes up with his own terms, and it seems like he doesn't do research on certain aspects of what the self is or how the self comes to mind. He'll reference a few individuals, but and I'm not, I don't want a book that just constantly references others as well. So he's trying to do perhaps too much, and it comes, the result is too little, or what can be described in maybe a short video of this is what a strange loop is, and we are odd creatures, and let's try to work together or something like that. But what I take away from Hofstadter is the fun parts. He talks about Daniel Dennett quite a bit, and I've read Daniel Dennett's work, and I didn't get too much out of the books, but I got the tail end of his latest book is kind of going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, with war and these disasters that can arise. In the last chapter of his book, somehow he tied it into we need to be prepared for like a technological disaster, like if all of the internet shuts down for even a week or something like that, then it would kind of disrupt the economy, the worldwide economy, disrupt all local events. So he was talking about how we need to go local and have kind of emergency plans in place in case, not just if the internet shuts down, but if, like, I don't know, the power goes out or some failure on that end, if we're relying too much on something. And that's what I remember from his book is, hey, that's a good idea. We need to, maybe that's a good focus for a community, is to think, how can we live locally? Like, where is this food going to come from? Rice is a staple in our family. And even though the pandemic is less and less on an odd wavy loop, there's not any rice in stores for weeks sometimes. And it's not a major loss for me. It's a minor loss for our family because they eat rice every meal. But I don't know the backstory, like where does the rice come from, the supply chain. And it's a big tangled mess that we're in, along with the war right now. It's a big tangled mess. Everybody is participating. The cancel culture idea from Twitter or whatever is now in the world at large, where big businesses are instantly canceling because they don't want to have a reputation of dealing with this nincompoop Putin, who's causing or saying a lot of things that is stirring up a lot of shit. And so internet culture kind of trickles into world culture. Elon Musk, maybe a couple days ago, said he wants to have a single man duel with Putin. And there's hundreds of thousands of people that say, yes, let's do it. And he's serious about it, I think. I haven't paid attention the past couple days to that thread, but that made the headline news, and Putin might respond and it might happen. Who knows? But at the same time, with the threat of nuclear war, it's a bit scary when somebody can just post something on Twitter, just like Trump did a few years ago, or somebody else might do, and it can cause the world to shift their mood, kind of flip-flop, like Hofstadter was talking about earlier with his eating habits. It's so easy to kind of flip-flop, like, oh, I will not support Russia, but maybe a news story will come out, and really we find out, even if Putin's the bad guy, Russians have really secretly been trying to promote world peace, and we want them to be a part of our larger community. But who knows what the hell is going to happen next? And so the book, I did read the book. I don't know how much we want to talk about the book. At 3 o'clock, I do need to go, but there's a lot of math that I think can be summed up in a couple sentences. And then he goes into the self and perception. And I'm not one to be critical, like kind of like Matt and a few others have said, I try to extract what is going to be useful. And but at the same time, this is a challenging read, even though it's not too dense.
I'm probably coming off critical, but not without appreciating what he's trying to do. My criticalness is what I said. I would like to speak to this notion. I don't know if it ties with him, but it's part of my come from. I posted something on interoception of the brain, working with the brain science. The brain has a part of it that wants to scan for what goes on, how we experience ourselves. And I think that's good to know and understand. And I think meditation and certain attention training helps up that skill, so that if we are going to come from a self-referential place, it's going to be skillful rather than just a knee-jerk reaction. I'm not sure why maybe I'm mishearing this, why self-referential, the way I've heard it, not just with him, but all through my life, has been almost shaming to have a self-referential point of view. I do agree that we need to be trained in what is that self? If I'm coming from my own self experience, referencing that, some people are on a spectrum of how well they even know what that is, what's happening inside of themselves, and why they have their biases. I don't know if that's part of the discussion or not. In listening to Doug and Marco, both of you, and the notion of self-referential, maybe I need more clarity of how it's being used.
I know, and I don't know what chapter, but it's the strangeness in the eye of the beholder. He gives another analogy. I can't remember. It's between the kleroderic individuals and a character that's supposed to be like Whitehead, who kind of sees it from the higher perspective, and then the pledgers, whatever they're called, can only see from the lower perspective. And so the Whitehead character can see all that's going to be, I guess they're trying to not consume these, or they're trying to determine what they can and cannot eat. And certain things will poison them. So Sir Whitehead is coming in and says, he sees it from this point of view and the others cannot see it, but at the same, so he's trying to use this analogy for the mind, or for the higher and lower mind. So we've got all these processes going on in our body, which we are unaware. He says we are not aware of these things, or cannot be. He goes that far as like we cannot know what it's like to be a cell moving around in our body. And also the higher part, maybe you can correct me if I'm not saying this correctly, but the kind of the illusory eye that forms from the brain is also, so that's coming from this higher self. So he's saying that's kind of the strangeness of the human is these interacting. So when it comes to being what you said, it's somewhat related, but I don't know.
Maybe that makes sense. It's hard. Like, I'm having trouble formulating what exactly is his point.
Right.
I want to try, I think we're trying, and we have a triad of trying.
Mm-hmm.
And try to understand where he's coming from, because I like him. And I said this in a previous cafe, that he's like a rare, rare bird. He's a weird one, you know? And I think that might have something to do with what is going on in the text and like what he's trying to say, because even though he's a mathematician and a logician and let's say a cognitive philosopher, he writes with an attitude of knowing or explaining. That might be what's annoying, is the sense that he's got it figured out in some way. And if you follow his argument about how an eye comes to be out of this analogical symbol like this simple manipulating process. I think though that part of what he's also doing is, I mean, part of what the point of that is for him is like to get out of math. Like, I think part of what he's doing is like exposing like the limits of logic. And that's what is so interesting and fascinating to him about what Gödel did with Principia Mathematica. Like, what Gödel did is that he looked at this system that Russell and Whitehead had created. And as I understand the system, it's kind of like an attempt to ground, you know, to ground math, like in the simplest possible, like elements, like what would be the, like the elements, the atoms, if you will, like of math that out of which you can build up the whole thing so that anything you put in at the beginning is going to remain true no matter how many permutations and functions that, you know, you generate out of those axioms and those rules. So it's supposed to be a perfect system, basically like a truth machine, right? Like, it's supposed to be a truth machine. Like, all you do, you give it a fact, you give it something you know is true, and then it can generate statements that must be true because they follow the rules of the system. And Gödel made that system say, in effect, I am unprovable. I am unproved. Like, that is that's the kind of condensation. That's like the simplest way of stating all of that stuff about, you know, the whole way he took Principia Mathematica and kind of mapped it onto a number system and then showed how you could just kind of create this like Fibonacci sequence, you know, of recursive, like ever more complex statements and ever bigger numbers. But what he did was make the system say, I am unprovable. And I think like that Hofstadter gives us that, like takes us through that whole thing in order to make like a meta point about the I, like the I, the self, who we are, that we have like a logical structure, but that the fact of our existence is not itself, the fact itself is not subject to the logical structure. Like it can't be proved by itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
And he's a very sensitive person. You know, like he is, like he has a rich eye. He has a rich like experience. He has deep relationships. Like he's a friend to people. He's has a husband. He's a dad. He has a professional life. He has students. And he has a quirky imagination. And he loves language. Obviously, he's really great at playing with language. So he has a lot of richness in his subjectivity. There's, I think, something about like what he's doing is, I don't know, it's like a way to dramatize, kind of like to make a point about himself, you know, to give like reality or to infuse meaning into a being that at some other level, and part maybe because of like his intense interest and immersion in mathematics and in logic, at some other level he doesn't fully believe in, like at some other level he feels is false or unprovable, and there's like a deep like tension or like dichotomy, like this is me maybe projecting, maybe I'm imagining, I'm thinking out loud, but some like deep kind of irreconcilable contradiction, like, because he's taking this problem of like, what is the I, Like, how does subjectivity, how does consciousness, how does the self, he uses these terms interchangeably. How does it arise? Where does it come from? What is it? And he's trying to answer that question. Like, he wants like the certainty of math proof, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
If it's true, it has a proof. If it has a proof, it must be true. And now the I is unprovable. I am unprovable. But he can't let go of the math, like, because he loves it. You know, like he wants that.
Does that mean because it's not provable, it's an illusion?
At one point he says that, I believe, but I don't know if that was just a passing phrase or a tenet of his framework. But he loosely implies it in places. In other places, I don't know. He might say more. It seems like he's approaching that in the writing.
I think we'd have to go pull out some quotes, but that's the
impression.
I remember reading that in various places. I can't pull the exact page, but because there is a sense that it's an illusion.
I'm asking you, Mark. Yeah, and I'm asking you, Marco, because of the word illusion. And I've referenced sometimes how that word actually has many meanings. And a lot of times when I hear mathematicians are coming from that place, they use it in a sense that something doesn't exist, which to me, illusion doesn't mean something doesn't exist. The illusion is how much the expansion of existence. It doesn't mean it doesn't have existence, but especially our human eye, probably the illusion is that we're separate from everything. You know, that's an illusion, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I don't know if I'm making sense, but it comes out of Alan Watts made this point. It's not that the eye is an illusion. It's in the sense that it doesn't, it's an illusion because it tries to maintain its separateness from infinity. And you can't prove that, right? That's not a proof. That's that aspect where something that steps in the area of faith. Something the area of faith is something that's beyond provability, but somehow, and I feel very strongly coming from this place with not trying to be arrogant, it does exist. You know, I have faith in it, in a sense.
Well, let's break it down. Like, let's, instead of two terms,
okay,
illusion and reality, let's introduce a third term. Let's introduce appearance. This is a philosophical term,
yeah.
Or we could call it phenomena. Phenomena is appearance. We have reality, phenomena, and illusion. All right, a phenomena is a phenomena. It until we name it, until we just try to say what it is, try to say something about it, it is what it is, right? A phenomenon occurs as a mental or psychic, an event in consciousness. I see a snake on the ground. But wait a minute, I get a little bit closer to the snake and I see that it's a stick. So—
Well, that's true.
I saw—
In one incident, that can be true.
there was a phenomena, and the judgment that it was a snake, the snake aspect of the phenomena, or the appearance of the snake, what appeared to me to be a snake, mm-hmm. was an illusion. The stick is real. Now, we can have a lot of ideas about our eye, about whether we're separate or not, qualities that we do or don't possess. And those could be maybe more real or more illusory. But there is a there's also the aspect of the phenomena or the appearance, which just is what arises. It's just what is. And I think that's part of what
and should you're we saying. Take, should what, we take that seriously?
Well, it's the only thing, right? I mean, what else is there but what, but like what, but the phenomena, like what?
Yeah.
I mean, what else is there to take seriously?
I'm glad you brought up that example of a snake, because it's used a lot and I understand it totally. But as a person that has worked at a state park, you know, you train your senses, you have to train yourself because you know something can look like something else. And you have to train your senses. And when people give that example, I'm going, okay, that's true. That can be a rope, but what if it was a snake? Then you've misjudged, you know, then you're going to get bit. So appearances, I guess what I'm saying, we do need to be like Goethe talks about the exact sensory imagination in terms of working with phenomenon, like you're saying, right? That there's this aspect that we can actually learn to trust our senses. And sometimes I'm overstating it, but I have a lot of problems and I know where it comes from because of being told I couldn't trust my senses, you know? And
I think there's also a difference between illusion, and I think we discussed this maybe in the first session or perhaps the second, but we kind of clarified illusion, hallucination. Imagination or the imaginal. We kind of had a discussion around all of the various ins and outs, but if we were to go back to Hofstadter, he does say at one point that the I, as the I that we call ourselves, so when I say I, that is a hallucination, hallucinated by a hallucination. He says that at one point. And that is believed by someone who believes in the strange loop, according to it looks like chapter 20. I looked up illusion, I looked up hallucination, and we haven't made it this far, but he has a dialogue between a believer in the ideas of I am a strange loop and a doubter in the ideas of I am a strange loop. Where Hofstadter stands, that's where I'm wondering at this point. He does navigate, he talks about his relationship with Dennett. We know where Daniel Dennett goes with his ideas. And there's not, it doesn't seem like in their dialogue, even outside of this book, that it's going to be butting heads anywhere, or it might be exchanging terms or exchanging ideas, but there isn't like a complete disagreeable or anything like that. So to call it an illusion, which I tend to, that term gravitates towards the more Buddhist perception of the self, I think. Hallucination, which is used by the believer in the ideas of a strange loop, is more of the maybe materialist or mentalist view that we are a hallucination, and what we see is a hallucination because it arises out of these neurons and processes inside of us, perhaps. Evan Thompson, in his book Waking Dreaming Being, is another, he kind of goes through this discussion at some point. Want to reread that because he's very good at honing in and staying focused on the various points of view and taking it a certain direction. But he doesn't agree with the hallucination part. He does side towards illusion, if I remember correctly. But again, these are terms, and your definition of the terms can depend on your background. So if I see a snake, and like you're saying, and it's a stick, but I'm still in the middle of the forest, I'm going to be looking out for other snakes that might be sticks as well. So it's good my processes are doing what they're doing. But and I might imagine, I know if I'm out in the woods and I'm using a substance, I'll be hallucinating or imagining or seeing and based on my thought processes at that time. So if I'm having a single one track mind, then that vision will be based on that one track mind. If I'm more open, then I will have perhaps more reception to the world around me, like Goethe, and
the opportunity. But let me ask a question, before I say anything, is I do like this book. I'm just expressing my agitation with some aspects of it, because it's a good thought experiment for me and what he brings out. So it's a good thought experience, and based on what both of you are saying, but is this may come out of left field, but is the loop he's talking about a closed loop, or is there a little bit of kind of looping into further loops, or, you know, that like a spiral, or, you know, something that, or, and then they have that of a circle, but when you get around to the end, it's open. You don't close the loop. You don't close the circle. So I'm not,
I think there definitely
an open-ended loop, I guess.
My reading of Hofstadter is that there definitely is. And he all, not only that, there's always new input, right? There's always new sensory input. We're always having new experiences.
Exactly.
And that alters the I, that alters the self pattern. Not only that, he also tries to account for intersubjectivity and how it is that we internalize the patterns of other eyes. So there are multiplicity of eyes, and they're each their own pattern. Mm-hmm. And this is his account, as I understand it, and it's in this, it might be in the strangeness in the eye of the beholder section. Like, we have a sense of our own loop, and then we encounter another person who is similar to our own selves. Like, they look like another human being, like as we see ourselves to be and feel ourselves to be. And so then, by analogy, we begin imagining them, and through our interactions with them, we begin ascribing, we begin understanding their own interiority, or like modeling,
That comes through a self-reference of our own history, right? That's got to be a component when we do that.
Right, through interacting with other
people. Yeah, like,
I have a sense of Michael.
Yeah.
I have a sense of Doug.
Yeah.
You have a sense of me. You have a sense of, like, we each have these senses of, and I'm saying senses, but I think what Hofstadter would say is we have these sort of symbolic loops. And they're not just like abstract. I mean, they're not just abstract symbols like the, you know, the notation from Principia Mathematica. Like, there's something in our brains. He doesn't call them, he doesn't want to call them neurons. He wants to call them symbols. And that's where he gets, he mixes, that's how he kind of accomplishes like the materialism, like how we go from the matter to the conscious experience. I mean, he's saying that something is happening in the brain that is itself, like, inherently aware and symbolic. And so we're not, I mean, I think if you follow what he's saying, we're not separate, because our strange loops incorporate and internalize other strange loops.
Okay.
And they also incorporate and internalize the, you know, the inputs that we receive through our senses, through our brain, from our environment. So, I mean, I think he's not like he's not completely crazy, right? He's not completely self-solved. I wanted to hone in on, like, what is the problem that we have then?
with Hofstadter in general?
I think so, because there's something that's bothering us all about this. And I mean, we're trying to appreciate it. And at the same time, we have this like critique, you know, like we're almost like sharks circling around like some flaw in the logic, some kind of logical, like.
I'm a snake in the grass.
Well, let me actually, if I may just finish, Doug, this kind of thought, like there's two different levels too that we're operating at. Like when we talk about the snake in the grass and whether a particular phenomena is illusory or not, or whether it's a hallucination, or it's real, like that's all talking about particular things, right? But when we talk about
I
and whether the I, whether like the self consciousness, like is itself illusory or real or apparent, then I think like a different order, it's a different level of perception, and we can't apply the same categories. So to say that, like that the eye is a mirage or is a hallucination, I think that there's no basis to say that, actually. And that's like where the mistake
That's what's irritating me. That's kind of the irritation. And maybe with what you just said, sorry to interrupt you, Marco, but with what you just previously said, talk about it, and that's why I'm glad we're talking about it. Some of it feels like I'm trying to find, I don't want him to talk like me, but find the common language maybe between us. Does that make sense?
I think so. But I do need to go in just 1 minute. I wanted to state, I don't know if it's a proposal of sorts, but that maybe the framing in general is incorrect in a certain way. And it could be, and speaking to what's wrong, maybe it's because of where we come from and either our past discussions and how we receive this, because there's hundreds of thousands of other people that have left great reviews that say this is a life-changing book. And so there's something to it, and maybe they're coming from the mathematical into this sense of the eye, or they're coming from certain perspectives, the scientific or mathematical. And I can see how this would be, just like Gerdel Escher, Bach was life-changing for a lot of other people and became a smash hit, it sounds like. But what I'm running into, so I'm also reading a few other heavy loads of a book that like Deleuze's Difference and Repetition, which kind of goes into the eternal recurrence, goes into similar types of notions of, so repetition would be this feedback loop in a way. And I kind of prefer, even though it's pretty dense material, what it's getting at, it takes into account more than some of the aspects that Hofstadter is getting into. Maybe I'll try to focus more on that. But for me, that the framing is part of the issue. Maybe he's focused too much on this notion of a strange loop, which can be maybe simplified into something, and he's working all around it, and it just doesn't make much sense.
I know when something irritates me, I want to get curious about it because it says something I need to learn. So I hope you guys understand it. It's irritating, but I take it with a curiosity. So thank you for putting up with my persnicketiness about this.
Well, it's been a interesting conversation, and I'm glad I have a pinch hitter here, Ed.
Ed's in town.
I gotta go. Yeah. See you guys.
All right, see you, Doug.
Oh, bye, Doug.
As he jogs off.
Oh.